it going forward. That's what the book is about. And if I've succeeded even 1% in what I've tried to do, I think it will help folks understand and help us all get through this together.
Okay, well, time flies when you're having fun. Thank you so much, Richard Heinberg. I really appreciate your coming on my show.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Okay, and KBOO.fm, go there, support KBOO, and get a copy of this book if you want it. $60 or more membership pledge. Thank you very much, and thanks, Ty. That's it for the show. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Fight the Empire at 9 a.m. Hey, boo. Yeah.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogering. The show is Fight the Empire. And I think today we'll talk a little bit about sort of what's going on in Ukraine. It's been, things look very ominous there. Russia apparently supposedly threatened to invade. And NATO wants to move into Ukraine, which is probably the reason that Russia is feeling bellicose. Anyway, it might be an idea to kind of get a bigger picture of what's going on in Ukraine, because there's a lot of history with Ukraine, and it's a kind of We can run through some of this history and then see where that leads us as far as today's events. Ukraine was actually and the Crimea was actually consolidated in the late 1700s by the Empress Catherine the Great, and she kind of moved into Ukraine and consolidated a warm water base, a naval base in the Crimea. And this lasted for for over 100 years, and then after the in 1919, after the Bolshevik Revolution, Moscow defeated Ukrainian resistance, and the country became one of the 15 republics of the USSR, and so the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which is no longer a union. Anyway, in 1954, this is a critical point right here, that in 1954, this was after Stalin's death, Nikita Khrushchev, who was a Russian but born near the Ukrainian border, he took power, and pandering to Ukrainian supporters, he unilaterally decreed that Crimea would be part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic and not the Russian Republic. And but since all the 15 republics of the USSR were under rule by Moscow, the switch was, as Ray McGovern puts it in his article, the switch was a distinction without much of a difference until later when the USSR fell apart. Then in November of 1989, the Berlin Wall came down, and later that year, December 2nd, George H.W. Bush invited Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to summit talks in Malta, and Bush, President Bush, reassured him that, quote, the U.S. will not take advantage, unquote, of Soviet troubles in Eastern Europe. Bush had already been pushing the idea of a Europe free and whole and free from Portugal to Vladivostok, which is at the eastern end of the Soviet Union in Asia. In 1990, Secretary of State James Baker negotiated a quid pro quo, that a Soviet acceptance of a reunited Germany inside NATO in return for an oral U.S. promise not to enlarge NATO, quote, one inch more, unquote, to the east. In December of 1991, the USSR fell apart, and all of a sudden it does matter that Khrushchev gave Crimea to the Ukrainian Republic, and because now the Ukrainian Republic is independent, not part of the Soviet system, which no longer exists. Moscow and Kiev, capital of Ukraine, work out long-term arrangements for the Soviet Navy to use the naval base at Sevastopol. This quid pro quo began to unravel in October 1996 during the last week of President Bill Clinton's campaign, when he said he would welcome Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic into NATO, the earlier promise to Moscow notwithstanding. Former U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock, who took part in these Bush-Gorbachev 1989 summit, has said the language used was absolute, including taking advantage by the U.S. Matlock went on to say, I don't see how anybody could view the subsequent explanation of NATO as anything other than taking advantage, particularly since by then Russia was hardly a credible threat. So from 16 members in 1990, NATO has grown to 29 members. The additional 13 are all east of Germany. In February of 2008, amid rumors of NATO planning to offer membership to Ukraine, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned U.S. Ambassador William Burns that, quote, yet means yet. Russia will react strongly to any move to bring Ukraine or Georgia into NATO. And thanks to WikiLeaks, we have Burns' original cable from the embassy in Moscow. In April of 2008, included in the final declaration from NATO summit in Bucharest, quote, NATO welcomes Ukraine's and Georgia's Euro-Atlantic aspirations for membership in NATO. We agreed today that these countries will become members of NATO, unquote. And in September of 2013, Putin helps Obama resist neocon demands to do a shock and awe on Syria. The Russians persuade President Bashar al-Assad to give up Soviet Syrian army chemical weapons for destruction on a U.S. ship outfitted for chemical weapons destruction. And the neocons are outraged over failing to mousetrap Obama into attacking Syria. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, in a speech to the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs Victoria Nuland said, quote, the United States has supported Ukraine's European aspirations. We have invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine. In February of 2014, amid rioting in Kiev, YouTube carries Assistant Victoria Nuland's last-minute instructions to U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt regarding the U.S. pick for a new Ukrainian prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, also known as Yats, and other plans for an imminent coup d'etat in Kiev. When Pyatt expresses concern about EU misgivings about mounting a coup, Nuland says, a word I can't use, blank the EU. She then apologized to the EU a day or two later for the profanity, not for the coup. She also says that Vice President Joe Biden will, quote, help glue this thing together, meaning the coup. In February 2014, there was a coup d'etat in Kiev, prominently labeled the most blatant coup in history by George Friedman, president of the think tank Stratfor. So going on with this chain of events, I can turn this page here, turning a page in history, as it were. Also in February 2014, the date that NATO, Western diplomats, and the corporate media have chosen as the beginning of recent European history, with silence about the coup orchestrated in Kiev the day before, President Putin returns to Moscow from the Winter Olympics in Sochi, and he confers with advisors about Crimea, deciding, unlike Khrushchev in 54, to arrange a plebiscite to let the people of Crimea, most of whom strongly oppose the coup regime, decide their own future. So in other words, you have this coup in Ukraine, and the people in Crimea, who by and large are majority Russian-speaking, opposed it. In March of that year, the official result from voters in Crimea was overwhelmingly for independence from Ukraine and to join Russia. Following the referendum, Crimea declared independence from Ukraine and asked to join the Russian Federation. On March 18th, the Russian Federal Assembly ratified the incorporation of Crimea into Russia. In the following days, Putin made it immediately and publicly clear that Yatsenyuk's early statement about Ukraine joining NATO And even more important, the U.S. NATO plans to deploy ABM missile systems around Russia's western border and in the Black Sea, with the prime motivating forces behind the post-referendum reincorporation of Crimea into Russia. Going on with this history, no one with rudimentary knowledge of Russian history should have been surprised that Moscow would take no chances of letting NATO grab Crimea and Russia's only warm-water naval base. The Nuland and her neocons seized on the opportunity to accuse Russia of aggression and told obedient European governments to follow suit. Washington could not persuade its European allies to impose sanctions on Russia until the downing of the Malaysian airline MH17 over Ukraine. So later that year, this plane was shot down, and it was widely blamed on either on Russia or on people acting on their behalf, I believe. So we might ask, how did this growing trust that President Putin wrote about in his earlier statements evaporate? How did what Putin called his close working and personal relationship with President Obama change into today's deep distrust and saber rattling? A short 3 hours, 3 years later, after the close collaboration Putin spoke of the feverish state of international relations and lamented, "My personal agreements with President of the United States have not produced results, and things have gone downhill from there." Well, that is Ray McGovern, a former CIA official, writing for Consortium News back in November of 2019. So that is sort of part of the whole story about Ukraine. If anybody has a question or a comment, please call 503-231-8187. This whole Ukraine thing is getting looks very ominous in many ways, and my big worry is that we are not getting a complete picture. We are getting a sort of a one-sided coverage, even on the better news reporting from National Public Radio. And they talk about the big worry is that lately, I think in the last few weeks, I've been hearing a lot of stories floated on the news about Russia supposedly with plans to invade Ukraine. And I don't know. To me, it just seems like a very, very foolish thing to do. I don't see what Russia would gain except a whole lot of trouble by invading Ukraine. I really don't think that they could do it, but that is just kind of my opinion. If anybody thinks differently, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. This is Fight the Empire on KBOO, your radio station. You have a voice in this station. Please use it. We always welcome comments and get a discussion going. So this is with all this talk about Russia invading Ukraine, I think what's passed over is that that Russia may have better options than an outright invasion. For one thing, there is there's another issue that's been in the news a lot last few years, is this gas there with the so-called Nord Stream pipeline, which takes natural gas from Russia and sends it to Europe. And this pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, goes under the North Sea from Russia to Germany. And it bypasses an earlier pipeline that went through Ukraine.
We have a caller.
And Ukraine was very upset about this because Ukraine used to get, used to collect fees from allowing the gas to pass under their territory. And with the Nord Stream pipeline, this does not happen. Ukraine is out. They don't get their fees anymore. But it does make sense from for Europe and for Russia. It's a more direct line, and it keeps the transaction simpler. And the main thing is it's Russia's gas. They are, you know, they have the they can sell it to whoever they want, whoever, any willing customer, and they can send that gas in any way that is agreeable to Russia and their customers. So Ukraine really has no reason to be in on this unless Russia and the European Union choose. So this is sort of where matters stand now.
We have a caller.
With this talk of invasion, kind of poisoning the atmosphere, and I think we should. I'm not saying we should be alarmed, but we should be watching this situation very carefully as it unfolds. I really recommend for people who want to understand more about events going on in the world. I recommend going online to Consortium News, and they have a lot of good articles there. And one of their regular authors is Ray McGovern, who spent about 27 years in the CIA before he retired, and he's become something of a global peace advocate. And so
we have a caller.
Oh, I believe we have a caller online. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Pear. I thank you for the historical context, and I just wanted to add a detail or two.
Mm-hmm.
Ukraine was historically a major vulnerability to the Russians, specifically during World War II. That was the path that the Nazis took when they were invading Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There are, to this day, there are elements that echo the sentiments of their grandparents or great-grandparents in Ukraine that were pro-Nazi. There's the use of the swastika by these elements to this day. These are the most vehemently anti-Russian elements within Ukraine. Those elements have been shelling urban centers. Many, many people have died. It hasn't been calm in the last few years. It's not been continuous, but there's been great violence by those that oppose Russia and want Ukraine, the Ukrainian separatists.
Mm-hmm. You had a coup d'etat where the elected president of Ukraine was kind of chased out of office by these violent street protests. That was a Viktor Yanukovych, who was kind of friendly towards Russia, and he was forced out. I guess he, what I hear, he kind of fled for fear of his life. And he thing you remember is that he was elected. And Ukraine is kind of a divided society where you have sort of Ukrainian-speaking people and Russian-speaking people, almost evenly divided. And the removal of Yanukovych kind of ended this balancing act, and so Ukraine has changed a lot since then. So go ahead with your comment.
Well, that one other point to make is that Crimea is the major Russian naval base. It would be the equivalent of Pearl Harbor. Nothing to simply shrug off by the Russians. If you could imagine, say China or Russia today wanting to seize Hawaii because there were somehow pro-Chinese or pro-Russian elements living in Hawaii, and they wanted to, to exploit that. It's not a trivial thing that it's that large a Navy base. This has been told to the American people without any of the context that you're bringing. We're only seeing Putin as the boogeyman who's got some kind of imperial aggression on his mind. There's no context whatsoever. I appreciate, again, your historical background. One other thing that most Americans have no idea about is that we lost about 400,000 people in World War II. If you want to get a mental picture, the Woodstock in 1969 was a crowd at its peak of about that many people, a large amount of people, and we could be somber and reflect on that loss. The Soviets lost about 25 million people, and the passageway for the Nazi armies leading into the Soviet Union was Ukraine. So the fact that there are now openly fascistic elements in Ukraine is on an emotional level cannot be minimized.
I don't know. I think Russia has reason to be worried. I mean, you know, Russia. You know, when you look at the geography of the region, Russia is it's on a big flat plain. There are no mountains blocking possible invaders. It has been invaded many times over the centuries, and they have reason to guard their borders. So this is that's one reason why they act the way they do on the world stage. They are not invulnerable. They are not safe behind an ocean or a mountain range. But anyway, a few minutes left to show. Do you have anything else you want to add to that?
Not really. Just in closing, the people that are driving this policy in Washington are very much similar to the mindset of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wrote the book The Great Chessboard or The Grand Chessboard. This sort of thinking that's coming out of D.C. Has nothing to do with world peace, harmony, maintaining some sort of reasonableness in the world. They basically see this as a game, and they see this as an opportunity to exploit certain vulnerabilities, and it's extremely dangerous because you don't want to be playing games with two nuclear armed powers. Right now that seems to be our direction. There are people in Washington that are chomping at the bit to have nuclear war. Well, they don't actually declare it to be a nuclear war, but they want a hot war with China. They want a hot war with Russia. And while they're not saying it's going to be a nuclear war, people that are worried about nuclear war are worried about those two flashpoints. Thanks, Pierre.
Well, thank you for your call. We have a few minutes left in the show. If anybody else has a question or comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187.
We have a caller.
We have another caller online. Hey, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I agree entirely with you and with the last caller. George Orwell's warning seems to be fulfilled. He said, everything is covered with mist. The past is erased. The eraser is forgotten. and the lie becomes truth. You know, people don't know about the coup in 2014 because our media is committed to just popular reporting. Nothing uncomfortable, you know. And this is so shameful. I think I read somewhere in a German article that there was a kind of a riot in Georgia, and this was blamed on Russia. And this is what always seems to happen in foreign policy. Foreign policy for us is just scapegoating, you know, and we're just totally oblivious to the real interests, the real necessities of Russia or of the other party.
Well, we're kind of stuck with this narrative, and you talk about the media. I'm sorry to say that even National Public Radio has kind of been pushing this line, and it's to me, it's very disturbing. This is sort of a false consensus is kind of papering over these real concerns, and if we're not careful, it may come back to a kind of hurt us all. So,
well, one lesson from the Afghanistan disaster.
We just got about 1 minute left, so go.
One lesson from the Afghanistan disaster was to turn away from the military-industrial complex. Right. This was $2.2 trillion over 20 years. That's $300 million a day. Thanks for your passion.
Well, thank you for your call. It's a very interesting discussion going on. I think we need to keep this discussion going on in the future because you might say it's our future, and the future of all our loved ones is at stake. So thank you very much for your call. It is 9:30, and this has been Fight the Empire. My name is